There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the deal we got? I mean, the deal we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
Hello, this is Quinn Hillier sitting in for Sean Sullivan today. Glad to be with y'all. And we have a doozy of a show coming up. We've got some really good guests, including Congresswoman Liz Cheney, incoming National Review editor Ramesh Panuru, commentary editor of the Washington Examiner, Con Carroll, and A.B. Stoddard of, you've seen her for 20 years on Fox and CNN and MSNBC and all over the place, as a very thoughtful analyst. So four big-time national guests coming up. But this is what we are basically going to be talking about. Just beyond the six-month mark of Joe Biden's presidency, it appears we are in for an extremely rocky ride. Even if we don't pass a $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill that is more social spending nonsense than it is bricks and mortar, and even if we don't pass the $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation bill that also wants to provide major amnesty for illegals and may require young women to register to vote, we still have a national debt that's almost 130% of gross domestic product. Anything over 100% is extremely risky. Historically, a safe number is way down below 70%. So we're leaving ourselves open either to having a debt called in or creating a panic or inflating ourselves into the sort of trouble that plagued Jimmy Carter's presidency or, eventually, that brought down Germany's Weimar Republic. Speaking of inflation, it's already started skyrocketing. Biden's war against domestic fuel production, his overspending, his insistence on making the government dole, literally pay more than many jobs, along with all the supply chain woes caused by COVID, but exacerbated by Biden's numerous executive actions, all of this is adding to inflationary pressures, rising at a rate that would equal 12% annual inflation in the next year if it continues. Biden's team throughout government is pushing wokeness over the market. In the military, it is pushing wokeness over readiness. In courts of law and in signals it sends to our schools, it's pushing the uber wokeness of critical race theory, the 1619 Project, another misnamed anti-racist claptrap that is actually the very definition of racism, teaching that so-called whiteness is evil. This is the Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris wing of the party that is in charge, trying to revolutionize all of American society, insisting that these United States are more guilty than good, that our faith is more bigotry than blessing. Biden's precipitous withdrawal from Afghanistan gives up our valuable Bagram air base in the process. It's handing the territory back to the Taliban, even though the bipartisan U.S. government study team predicted that as a result, terrorists harbored by these brutes are likely to strike the U.S. homeland again within 36 months. We should keep the air base and much more. Everywhere we turn, we wonder why Biden is doing what he's doing. He makes no sense. Why did he kill the Keystone Pipeline? only to give a green light to Russia's destabilizing Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Why did he try to nullify existing oil leases in Alaska and block new lease sales on all government lands and waters? And why, for goodness sakes, has he completely surrendered our sovereignty through policies that may as well put a huge blinking neon welcome sign at our southern border? Letting in illegals in record numbers, failing to interdict hardened criminals, halting deportations, creating a truly horrific humanitarian crisis. The list goes on. This is a bad administration, and it's getting worse. I could go on and on about the things that he is doing wrong, but for now, you get the picture. For the next 2 hours, we'll be talking about how to survive the Biden years and how to recover from them. I've mentioned my four superb guests, Liz Cheney, Ramesh Bunuru, Con Carroll, and A.B. Stoddard. There will be times when you can call in at 343-0106, and it should be a really, really good show. So please do listen in as we figure out how do we survive the Biden years? How do we not just survive them, but recover from them? What do we do? What strategy do we use as not just as conservatives, which I am, but as Americans? Because, frankly, we're in for a very rocky ride. So, that said, we may be able to get started in just a moment. But right now, we will go to this break, and then we will come back, I believe, with Congresswoman Liz Cheney making a rare appearance on local radio far from Wyoming and far from Washington, D.C. This is Quinn Hillier on WABH.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Hello, this is Quinn Hillier sitting in for Sean Sullivan. Glad to be with you all, and I am absolutely delighted to have as our next guest somebody very much in the national news these days and a longtime friendly acquaintance to those of us down here. She worked very closely with Congressman Bradley Byrne when he was congressman, supporting national defense, including all sorts of ways that national defense helped all of our military installations down here. I'm delighted to welcome Representative Liz Cheney. Liz, welcome to the show.
Well, it's really my pleasure to be on with you, Quinn. I'm a longtime fan of yours and friend and good friend of Bradley's as well. And we certainly miss having Bradley in the House of Representatives.
Well, thank you for coming on with us. And I'm not sure that people who have just started paying attention in the last couple of months realize just what a long-standing conservative leader you have been, but you have thought long and hard strategically about how to advance conservative causes. And I sort of wanted to throw it open to you. I started the broadcast today with a litany of all the things, or I only got halfway through them, the things that Joe Biden has done, that his administration has done, that we don't particularly appreciate. How do we survive the Biden years? What do we do to keep him from doing the worst, to advance American interests, and then again, strategically thinking long term to recover from them?
Well, that is such a crucial question. You know, I think that what we have to be able to do is provide the American people with an alternative, demonstrating why we've got to fight back against the Biden policies that are so dangerous. And provide an alternative that's based on substance and on values and on explaining what we stand for as Republicans and what we believe in, that we will fight for cutting regulations, we'll fight for low taxes. We recognize that the federal government right now is doing a whole bunch of things it should not be doing, that, you know, conservatives believe in limited government and states' rights, and and certainly a strong national defense. And you mentioned Bradley Byrne, and Bradley and I really got to know each other serving on the Rules Committee, but then also on the Armed Services Committee. And, you know, one of the real areas where we're facing vulnerabilities today is internationally. And it's an area where we've seen the Biden administration really fail to step up to the plate, do what's necessary. You know, you just had in the last couple of days this announcement that they're going to go ahead with the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which, you know, provides Russian natural gas to Germany. And it's really something that should not go ahead, that there's no reason in the world why they would want to provide those resources to the Russians. And I think that it's just the latest example of a number of misguided policy moves, both, you know, on the national security front and domestically, we've seen from the Biden administration.
Well, what sorts of things are you working on most directly right now, either in the realm of national defense or otherwise, that you think people really need to pay more attention to?
Well, there are a number of things. I think, you know, domestically, a lot of the issues that I work on obviously are ones that really matter for us in Wyoming. You know, we're a big energy-producing state. We've got a lot of agricultural producers and interests across our state. And so the Biden policies with respect to, you know, looking at things like the Green New Deal, for example, those really are just, they're misguided, and they will certainly hurt our economy in Wyoming, but obviously all across the country. So working on making sure people, that we're fighting against those policies and that we're helping educate people about the truth of how important our energy industry is. Really concerned and focused on the debt and the extent to which we've seen trillions of dollars appropriated in the last 6 months. And in many cases, you know, we've had these massive bills. We had a $1.9 trillion bill that was sort of described as a COVID relief package. It had some good things in it. It had a lot of things in it that weren't connected to COVID. But, you know, that passed the House of Representatives, you know, with maybe a little over an hour of debate. And that's not the way Congress should work. So we have a whole bunch of domestic issues. I'm also, as a mom, I've got five kids. I'm very focused on education and then where our school systems are just really failing, especially to teach our kids American history, to teach our kids, you know, what a miracle this country is, what a miracle our founding was. And so focused on ways that we can help to ensure that we're giving states and local communities resources to do that without, you know, federalizing the education process, obviously.
Well, on the latter, your mother, of course, headed the National Endowment for the Humanities, and I can remember sitting in a congressional hearing back in the 90s when she was talking about the importance of teaching civics and American history and appreciation for the greatness of this country. We are now faced with people teaching just the opposite with the 1619 Project, critical race theory. Does this particularly hit home with you because of all the good work your mother did in the alternative?
Well, certainly, you know, I feel really blessed, you know, to have been, you know, raised in a house where these were issues we're talking about. My mom, I'm very proud of all the work that she's done. She was talking about these issues, you know, 25 and 30 years ago. And if anything, it's gotten worse since then. And look, I think, you know, we've got to be able to know that when our kids graduate from high school, graduate from college, that they're equipped with a recognition and an understanding of what it takes to, you know, defend our republic, to defend our Constitution, the rule of law, and they ought to be, you know, proud of the fact that they, you know, live in the most exceptional nation that's ever existed. And we certainly are not perfect by any means, but we really need to get back to making sure people understand the way to accomplish the ideals and the values of our founding documents is through the founding documents and through fidelity to them. And I think you've seen parents all across the country turn to homeschooling, for example, because they just don't believe our school systems are playing the role they need to play. And I certainly support homeschooling. I think it's tremendous for parents to be able to do that. I think we also got to make sure our public schools are doing a much better job as well.
Well, and as you said, this is not something you necessarily want to federalize. The answer should be in states and localities. But what can somebody in Congress, not necessarily by law, although you can certainly block some bad things by law, but what can national leaders do to encourage localities and parents to do the right thing?
Yeah, I think, one thing that we can do is demonstrate, that a lot of these issues should be bipartisan. And, I've had discussions with colleagues on the Democratic side of the aisle, moderate Democrats, for example, who, it's interesting, a number of them on the Armed Services Committee, as we've been talking about, what do we need to do to make sure that, we're conveying to the American people that these issues about our Constitution are above politics, and are there ways that we can, help to support some of the charitable entities and private groups that are working on these issues, help to support, school systems through competitions, through forums, ways that we can really help people to recognize how much the Constitution means really in everybody's daily life and how important it is to defend it. I think also, I certainly don't support, the kind of thing we saw with Common Core, the kind of national federal standards, but really helping to support those parents organizations. I know we've seen in counties across Wyoming, parents groups challenging the curriculum that's gone so far left. And I think that, individual members can certainly help to provide information, resources, and networking for parents that are fighting these battles. And then finally, I think it's important to work so that, I'd like to see our home school laws, our charter school laws, work in each state to help to make sure that parents are the ones that get to make these decisions and that they're backed up by our state and local governments. I think that's very important.
I think a lot of my listeners would agree with everything you just said. For those who don't know, we are talking to Congresswoman Liz Cheney of Wyoming, longtime conservative leader nationally. And she is, of course, talking common sense. We're running short on time, but you mentioned the debt. We face a $1.2 trillion infrastructure proposal and a $3.5 trillion boondoggle for Lord knows what. Obviously, in my mind, we can't afford this. We don't have much time, but just tell us, can either or especially the latter, the $3.5 trillion one, can it be blocked?
I certainly hope so. I think it has to be. I mean, we could be facing the Democrats trying to use the reconciliation process to pass some of this, which means they don't need 60 votes in the Senate. But our spending is completely out of control, and we're getting close to the point where, we're nearing a fiscal cliff. The Treasury Secretary just announced today that we're going to hit the debt ceiling by August 1st. We've got to get control of our spending, and we've got to get economic policies in place that are going to allow economic growth to generate revenues that we need. But raising taxes is not the answer. Borrowing more from the Chinese is not the answer. Printing money is not the answer. We really need to be much more fiscally responsible.
Congresswoman,
on both sides.
Thank you very much for coming on the show. Congresswoman Liz Cheney, keep up your good work. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Flynn. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Bye.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
This is Quinn Hillier sitting in for Sean Sullivan, and we welcome your calls, especially for the next 10 minutes till our next guest gets on. The number is 343-0106. That's 343-0106. We've just been listening a very special guest appearance from Congresswoman Liz Cheney, reminding us of what we need to do as conservatives on policy matters across the board, on education, on fighting debt, on standing up for national defense. And I was really glad to have her on. She has been a very good friend to this area, supporting our military installations and shipbuilding and things like that, and so was really happy to have her on. The main theme of this show is surviving the Biden administration. It has just passed its six-month mark. That means we have 3.5 more years to go, and it is proving to be a radical, nearly revolutionary left-wing administration, at least in terms of what they have been trying to do. And we need to figure out strategically how to supersede this, how to bring Biden back to being the at least semi-moderate that he pretended to be on the campaign. You know, Bill Clinton, his first 2 years, people forget how far left he tried to be in those first 2 years, and we fought him, and we beat him on some big things, and we brought him back to the middle. And even though we didn't like a lot of what he did in the last 6 years, but he governed as a center leftist, and that left the country in not so bad a shape. Nowhere near as bad a shape as if he had kept pushing left. And so even though we know where Biden wants to go, we need to move him back to the center. We have a phone caller. And is it Doug? Doug, what do you have to say?
Quinn, I value a lot of your opinions. Some of them I don't agree with. Most of them I do. Having said that, your experience in the Hill and in the politics of the nation, particularly in the state, I have a question that no radio host has yet to talk about that I have heard of, and I think it needs to be a very big and involved topic of discussion. With Mo Brooks leaving his seat in Congress to run for the Senate, okay? Now, I have no doubt about the man's integrity. Don't get me wrong. My question is, what does the state of Alabama lose in the halls of Congress by a senior, experienced congressman moving over, giving up his seat to jump over to the Senate to become a junior senator, and therefore turning our seat over in Congress to a junior, being a Democrat or Republican?
Well, we have
This is a subject that I think really needs to be talked about in great detail. What are we going to lose?
Well, that's a very good.
What are we going to gain?
That's a very, very good question, Doug. I appreciate your asking it. And like it or not, seniority matters on Capitol Hill, and Alabama has lost a ton of seniority in the last few years. We lost seniority when Jeff Sessions left the Senate. We lost seniority that had started to develop when Bradley Byrne tried to run for the Senate. We lost seniority when I'm drawing a blank on her name, wonderful U.S. representative from the Wiregrass area. Come on.
I don't live over there.
Yeah, anyway, she was wonderful. I'm just drawing a blank on her name. We have lost, and we're about to lose some of the biggest seniority you can have when Richard Shelby retires, which means 2 years from now we are going to have about as little seniority across the board as you can possibly imagine for a state our size.
Exactly right. And what are we losing in the hall of Congress? Now,
I'm sure Mr. Brooks
sits on several of the committees, and he carries, I guess, a lot of seniority in those halls. I'm not even exactly sure how long he's been in Congress. But nonetheless, he is a senior, or more senior than what we're going to wind up with.
I believe he's been there since 2012 or maybe even 10. I know it's at least it was at least the 2012 elections when he got in, but it might have been 2 years earlier. Once you've been there about 10 years, it's not just that you get, you know, some sort of mythical seniority. You get you actually move up in the ranks of the committee and you get better committee spots. And I worked in Congress for 5 years and I saw what that meant. And it means that as the bills go through, you get to shape them. I'm not talking about just for pork barrel stuff. I'm talking about for policy issues. It is not pork barrel. It's not spending federal money to weigh in on the Gulf fisheries. But you're in a much better position to weigh in on Gulf fisheries, for instance, and on the snapper limits and things like that if you've been there 10 years than if you haven't. So anyway, you bring up a very good point. I appreciate your call, and that is something Alabamians definitely need to think about. I believe we have – who else do we have coming on? Sorry about that. I'm trying to get used to the phone system. Anyway, Doug, thank you very much for your call. I do appreciate it. And I think we have another call coming in, but until it actually comes in, let me just say, this administration, when I started the show, I started a litany of the things that it's doing that are really rather radical. And I only got halfway through. I mean, why is this man who came in promising moderation acting closer to a Menshevik than a moderate? It's a softer socialism than the brutal Bolsheviks, but it's still an attempt at radically changing society to some version of a left-wing fantasy land where the state dominates, where group identity is paramount, where the only individuals that are actually allowed individuality are those who buy into Biden's newly, quote, transformed world. If you aren't worried by this, you should be. Stagflation threatens. Foreign weakness and domestic wokeness sap our confidence. We face Jimmy Carter's malaise, exacerbated by much worse debt, and policies that are much more left-wing than Jimmy Carter's were. But without even the saving grace of Carter's desire to deregulate some industries and ensure transparency. And what is this? Okay, this should make everybody scared. Adding an astonishing $80 billion to the budget of the IRS. The Biden-Pelosi-Schumer plan isn't to add to the IRS departments that provide assistance to confused taxpayers, not for the helplines, not for the appeals courts that can help resolve disputes and actually listen to the complaints by the confused consumers. No, this is all about enforcement, or more like harassment, with an ungodly number of new agents to conduct audits, to rig the appeals process against ordinary taxpayers, all in order, literally, this is how they want to pay for their infrastructure plan, by adding more IRS agents to bring in hundreds of billions more in tax dollars to justify the $80 billion more in IRS spending. This reminds me of one of the most important complaints in the Declaration of Independence, namely that a far-off government has, quote from the Declaration, sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out our substance. This is what we're going to be talking about again for the next hour and 15 minutes. And we are going to have some great guests, including very shortly, we are going to have call in Con Carroll, who is the new commentary editor of my publication, The Washington Examiner. But he's fresh off of Capitol Hill. And there he worked for constitutional conservative Senator Mike Lee, whose father, by the way, Mike Lee's father, was the Solicitor General for Ronald Reagan. Lee himself is a constitutional scholar, and Con Carroll really understands the need to stick to constitutional government. And he will be on to talk about what he hopes the Washington Examiner can do about that, what life was like on Capitol Hill, whether or not Capitol Hill can be fixed, what can be done so that we, as Americans, can take control of our government again. He's going to be on very shortly. And again, meanwhile, this is Quinn Hillier, who is sitting in for Sean Sullivan. Is that Khan right now? Maybe not. Sorry about the delay. More coming up. What? Otto is on the line until Khan. Hello?
Hello.
Is this Otto?
No, it's just Khan. Sorry, not Otto.
Khan. Very good. That's who I was hoping for. Khan, Khan Carroll, welcome to the show. I was just telling our listeners about you taking over as commentary editor of the Washington Examiner and about the years you spent on Capitol Hill working most recently for constitutional conservative Mike Lee. Welcome to the show, Khan.
It's a pleasure to be on.
Thanks for coming on. I want to ask what a lot of people ask. Why is Capitol Hill broken? Can it be fixed? You were just there. You saw how it worked. You saw how it did not work. Hello?
Yeah, no, I'm still here.
Oh, we have a quick break. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Can you hold for just a second?
Absolutely.
Thanks.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Okay, this is Quinn Hillier sitting in for Sean Sullivan, and sorry we got interrupted. We have Khan Carroll, the commentary editor of the Washington Examiner. Welcome back, Khan. And I was starting to ask you what you saw in the time you were on Capitol Hill. You did what I did quite a while ago. You went from journalism up to Capitol Hill, and now I've come back to journalism. Is there a message in that?
No, actually. I loved my time on the Hill. I loved serving. It's still a lot of fun. It's still great to walk through the hallways every day. I did, however, want to write a book, and that's why I came back over the journalistic side. It's hard to get a publisher to publish your work when your name is attached to someone else's every action. So, I do miss the Hill. It's a great place.
Well, most Americans seem to think Capitol Hill is broken. It's certainly not working great. Is it broken or is it just damaged?
I would say just damaged. I think it's a very fair assessment to say things obviously aren't going great right now. Americans are very reasonably upset with what is going on. But I do think it's fixable. I think the major problem is that the leadership in both parties has become too powerful. So that's Pelosi's office, that's McCarthy's office, that's Schumer's office, that's McConnell's office. Republican senators and House members, everyone is just too willing to defer power and decision-making authority to leadership. And I think that's what makes it such a terrible place these days.
How can that be fixed, Khan?
Well, it can be fixed by voting for people that are willing to speak their minds. And, you know, there's a lot of Republicans out there who just always toe the line and salute whenever Mitch McConnell says one thing or takes a position on one thing. And McConnell does a great job. You know, the job's herding cats. But when he was majority leader and now that Schumer's majority leader, there's just a number of things that they've done to consolidate power in leadership hands. So I think if you're conservative and you're looking for someone to vote for in a primary, I think you want someone who really is going to be independent from that leadership to say, look, I like McConnell. He does an okay job, but I'm not going to do everything he tells me to. I'm not going to vote the way he tells me to vote. I'm going to vote my mind. I'm going to vote with you in mind, and I'm not just going to do what the Washington establishment wants me to do.
Gotcha. speaking of the Washington establishment, the establishment is now the Biden administration. And I have gone through a litany in this first hour of all the ways that it is proved that this is an administration that is proving far more radical than the image that Biden put forth when he was campaigning. Mm-hmm. I know this is a big, broad question, but knowing how Capitol Hill works, knowing how sometimes it's hard to get things done, which in this case could be a good thing. It can stop a lot of bad things. What can we as conservatives, as Americans, do to survive the Biden years? And how do we reinvigorate a constitutional conservatism that can govern?
Get involved. And I don't just mean federally, although that will help too, but get involved locally. I mean, there's so many issues out there today where Biden is making people's lives worse that you can try to counter on the local level. There's critical race theory in schools, in our armed services, in pretty much any institution you can think of. It's being shoved down our throats. You can get involved in school races. When you look at things like immigration, you have all of these migrants that are coming in across the border. They're being bused, flown, driven to communities all over the nation. People need to keep track of that and say, you know, who is feeding these people? Who's clothing these people? Who's educating these people? Who's providing health care for these people? And those stories will come up in local news, and people need to publicize them, remember them, and then, you know, vote for the right people next November when it comes to punishing people who cooperate with that scheme.
I'm glad you brought up how important it is to get involved at the local level. I don't know if you're a fan of Ilya Shapiro of the Cato Institute.
I do know Ilya, yes.
Ilya is a great constitutional conservative, and he is right now running for school board in a district in Northern Virginia. Now, this is the vice president of one of the top think tanks in the country, but he is taking the time out to run for a local school board seat because he is upset with how the schools are being run. It's not just critical race theory and Common Core. It's discipline issues. It is teachers not being responsive to parents, or it's certainly school board members not being responsible to parents. I think that's a good model. If somebody like Ilya can take the time to run for a local school board, maybe other people can too. But what if there's anything that you hope to do? You just joined us. You're running our commentary page.
Mm-hmm.
What if anything, do you hope to accomplish through conservative media to push some of these ideas?
Well, I think right now, I think the conservatives should be in a mode of holding Biden accountable. And not just Biden, but the entire progressive movement. I mean, they are kind of at an apex of their power right now. Trump was very unpopular in much of the country, and you have progressive district attorneys around the country that are inflicting a whole bunch of policies on large cities that are just having disastrous consequences. So, you know, when it comes to what I want to do with the Examiner, it's, you know, just to document this all and to be a resource for conservatives to be able to tell that story of, look, there's terrible things going on at the border, directly a result of what Biden did. There are terrible things going on in our nation's cities as a direct result of George Soros' efforts to elect all these far-left prosecutors, so that we have this data available, and we then have those stories available, so that when it comes to voting time, that we'll have these narratives ready. We'll have these stories ready to tell our neighbors, to tell our family, and say, look, this is why this election is important.
How do you see the elections looking in 2022?
Oh, it's too far out still. It's too far out. I mean, you never know. There could be a Supreme Court justice that passes, and that could change everything. There could be, you know, a violent incident on the border or a terrorist attack somewhere. It's too far to see. But I think right now you see, you know, Biden barely holding on to his approval rating. Kamala Harris is vastly going under. I think you see definitely on immigration, Biden's numbers are hugely underwater. And if the economic situation keeps going as it is with higher and higher inflation, I think a lot of people are going to turn on that issue too. So there's definitely a possibility that it could be a very bad year for Democrats in 2022.
I'm saying the same thing. If the Republicans do make gains in 2022, who are some of the more thoughtful and effective members of the House or the Senate up there that that people, conservatives across the country, should be looking to for leadership?
Well, I'm not going to say Mike Lee because I worked for Mike Lee for 7 years. I'm biased, so I'm not going to say Mike Lee, but he already did twice. But there are new candidates that I am very much interested in. There's J.D. Vance out in Ohio and Blake Masters out in Arizona. These are candidates that haven't gotten through their primary yet, so they have to beat other Republicans. But they have a populist take on what is wrong with Washington that I think is largely correct. And I think their viewpoint is sorely needed on Capitol Hill.
Who are some of the people that are already on Capitol Hill, other than Mike Lee, who I totally agree with, is a wonderful guy? We have 1 minute, but who are some of the others that you see that could be or are good leaders?
I do like Nancy Mace. I think she's been doing a good job.
Congresswoman from South Carolina, right?
Yes. I'm sorry. Congresswoman from South Carolina. Nancy Mace. Sometimes you work on the Hill and you forget that not everyone knows where everyone's from. But yes, I think she's done a good job both serving her constituents and creating a unique profile for herself. It doesn't help that she's an attractive, well-spoken woman.
We are running out of time, but thank you so much for coming on. Sorry for the little glitch right at the beginning, but I really appreciate your coming on. Con Carroll of the Washington Examiner.
Thanks, Quinn.
Thanks.
Bye. There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the deal we got? I mean, the deal we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question.
Hello, this is Quinn Hillier sitting in for Sean Sullivan on Midday Mobile, and we appreciate your listening. And now I am really excited to have our next guest on the air. He is Ramesh Panuru. He has been a friend of mine for 25 years, I believe, since his very first weekend as a staffer for National Review in Washington. And Ramesh is in transition to become only the fourth ever editor of National Review magazine, and has been a wonderful voice for conservatism and country the last 25 years. Ramesh, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
That, definitely glad to have you. First of all, congratulations on your pending promotion, although I assume that a lot of what you've been doing for the last 25 years you'll keep on doing, but only more so. Is that right?
That is the plan, and thank you.
Well, you have been an extremely eloquent voice, including for issues of life. Way back in 2006, you wrote a very good book called The Party of Death, among other things, arguing against almost the fetishism of death on the left, the lack of respect for life. Well, now just yesterday, there is a lawsuit filed in Mississippi, or at least a brief filed in Mississippi for the pro-life cause, and it is really raising some eyebrows. People think it's particularly well done. Will you tell us about that, Ramesh?
Sure, I'd be glad to do that. Mississippi has a law, or has tried to have a law, democratically enacted, that bans abortions after 15 weeks gestation. That is something that, as popular, even a lot of people who believe abortion should be legal early in pregnancy are for that. And 95% of abortions are before that time limit. So we're talking about a small number as well. But the Supreme Court's case law on this question is so extreme that it puts that kind of law in jeopardy, makes it a question whether that kind of democratically enacted law can be sustained. So that's the question that the Supreme Court has taken up, and the Mississippi Attorney General, Lynn Fitch, has worked with some of her colleagues and filed a brief where she says it's time for the Supreme Court to get out of micromanaging abortion policy and simply say that Roe v. Wade and its successor cases are no longer good law, that these things are overturned, and it's up to democracy, it's up to legislatures, it's up to voters to determine how much or how little protection for unborn life there's going to be.
And is their argument specifically, therefore, to overturn Roe?
That's right. They make the point that Roe is absurd, treated as a good faith interpretation of the Constitution. There's no right to abortion in the text of the Constitution. We can now do something we couldn't do back in 1973, and we can do a control F for abortion in the text of the Constitution. It's not there. And none of the euphemisms, so like reproductive rights, are there either. It's not the original understanding of the Constitution. Nobody who adopted the Constitution, nobody who ratified the 14th Amendment, believed that it was saying that legislatures can't protect unborn human life, which, in fact, almost all legislatures at the time did, and were doing more at the time the 14th Amendment was ratified. So the entire case really rests on whether Roe and its successor cases, even though they're absurd as readings of the Constitution, have to stand just based on there being a precedent that's been in place for several decades. And the brief makes a thorough and, I think, very compelling case against sticking with this tremendous error just because it would involve the court saying it made a mistake.
The practicalities of this are something I'm not sure people understand. I think a lot of people think that if you get rid of Roe, suddenly all abortions across the country will be illegal. People who understand how this works knows that's not how it works. The Mississippi case you mentioned is about a law that would outlaw abortion after 15 weeks. Now, when Roe first came down, most people thought, oh, it set up this trimester system. It didn't really, but they thought it made it. It still left it illegal in the third trimester and sometimes legal in the second and only totally legal in the first trimester. Well, 15 weeks is beyond the first trimester. If you go across the country, state by state by state, what do you think happens if Roe is overturned? Do you get a lot more laws like Mississippi's where it still allows 94% of abortions in terms of actual numbers, or what? What happens?
Yeah. Well, you've raised a cluster of great points and questions there. Let me start by just clarifying what the state of abortion law is, because there's so much confusion and misinformation on this point. As you say, a lot of people are under the misimpression that Roe v. Wade and its successor cases allowed bans on abortion late in pregnancy. And that's essentially untrue, because the same day Roe came down, the court made a ruling called Doe v. Bolton. And when you put those two cases together, what it has said, what the Supreme Court has consistently said from 1973 onwards, is that abortion can't be prohibited at any stage of pregnancy, no matter how late, if the abortionist believes that the abortion will promote the mother's health, including her psychological health and her emotional health. So that in practice means you just can't ban abortion even in the second trimester, even in the third trimester. Now, if the Supreme Court gets out of the way, if it overturns Roe and its previous cases on abortion, that doesn't mean abortion is illegal everywhere. It means that legislatures can now set the abortion policy that voters in a particular area want. Now, New York State has, for example, already legislated saying even if Roe goes away, it's going to have the same basic policy in place, actually maybe a little bit more liberal than what the Supreme Court has ruled. Texas just recently passed a law saying that if Roe goes away, it's going to try to have as much protection for unborn children as possible. It's going to have steep fines and take away the medical licenses of people who commit abortions unless it's to save the life of the mother. And you're going to have different laws based on what the sentiments of different groups in the country are. You're not going to have the same laws in Alabama and in Rhode Island. But I think, I think one thing that's really important here, particularly for those pro-lifers who are tempted to minimize the importance of this because there'll still be so many fights ahead, I think it's really important just in itself that we no longer maintain the fiction that the Constitution says that unborn children are unpersons who can't be protected. That, I think, is a real stain on the country that gets removed if the Supreme Court reverses its grievous error from nearly 50 years ago.
And what you're saying is that even if you set aside the question of whether or not abortion should be legal, that respect for the actual text of the Constitution says that this should not be an issue that that is really constitutional in nature. I mean, that's sort of overstating it, but isn't that basically the case?
There is nothing in the Constitution that authorizes federal judges to protect abortion from legislative regulation, restriction, and prohibition. That, you know, if a legislature wants to prohibit abortion, a federal judge may disagree with it, but it's really not that judge's place. It is not within his authority as given by the Constitution to second-guess that decision of the legislature and the people.
I happen to agree with you, but I'm glad that you laid this out in such interesting ways. Listeners, I'm talking to Ramesh Panuru, longtime writer for National Review, soon to be editor of National Review magazine, the flagship conservative magazine for lo these, 65, 67 years. Ramesh, we don't have a lot more time, but in about 2 minutes, moving off of the Mississippi case, moving off of abortion, very broadly speaking, where do you see grounds or opportunity or hope for those of us who think the Biden administration is going way, way, way too far left? And we want to know, how do we survive for these next 3.5 years? What do we need to do and what are the chances of escaping with minimal damage and then you know, maybe transcending it in the future?
This is an administration, this is a progressive movement whose eyes are bigger than its stomach. They have very narrow majorities in the House and the Senate. They've got grand ambitions. Those two things are going to collide, and that's going to create a big problem, I think, on the Democratic side. It's going to create a lot of infighting among the soft left and the hard left within the Democratic Party. And I think there's going to be a lot of dashed hopes. When you look at the long list of things that are supposedly priorities for the Democratic Party that are just not possible, everything from an assault weapons ban to D.C. statehood to the Equality Act, I don't think any of those things are going anywhere. What they can do is spend a lot of money, raise our taxes, and that's got to be fought. But I think that there's a good chance that they are going to mobilize a coalition of conservatives and centrists against them that gives them a pretty bad set of midterm elections.
Ramesh Panuru of National Review, thank you so much for coming on our show. I really appreciate your taking the time. And again, congrats on your pending promotion. It is very well deserved.
Thanks. Always a pleasure to talk to you, Quinn.
Thanks, Ramesh. Bye.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Hello, this is Quinn Hillier filling in for Sean Sullivan, and we have been talking conservatism and country for the last hour and a half. Especially in the next 5 minutes or so, we welcome callers at 3430106. That's 251-343-0106. We have a guest coming up at 1:30. You've seen her on national news stations for years, for two decades, on Fox News, on MSNBC, on CNN, on Sirius Radio. It is A.B. Stoddard. The reason that she appears on so many of these networks is because she's one of the few fair-minded centrists, and so everybody wants her. She doesn't necessarily take sides. You can expect thoughtful, fair-minded, sort of neutral analysis. What does it all mean? And A.B. has been a friend of mine since she was covering Capitol Hill when I worked there, although these many years ago. I've aged. She has not. But she should be very, very good, very interesting to put all this that we've been talking about in perspective. And meanwhile, if you want to call in before she comes on in the next several minutes, 343-0106. I wanted to talk about what Ramesh Panuru was just discussing in our last segment. Ramesh is the longtime writer for National Review, soon to be editor of National Review magazine. And he spent most of the time talking about a new abortion lawsuit. But right at the end, I asked him, I got back to the theme we've been talking about in the show, and that is what do we do if we're worried that the Biden administration might be successful at pushing the country so far to the left? And I had gone through my litany, including the massive, massive spending unprecedented in American history that he is trying to foist upon the country, even though our national debt is already nearly 130% of gross domestic product. And Ramesh said something very, very important. And it's something that I've included in an editorial I drafted for The Examiner just yesterday. And that is, if you push too hard and too far, you fall over yourself. We saw it with Bill Clinton in his first 2 years. We saw it with Barack Obama in his first 2 years, where they pushed too hard, too far, and lost big in the next elections. Because you not only do you create a backlash, not just on the right, but in the center, But you also, there are still slightly more centrist Democrats who won't go as far as a $3.5 trillion spending bonanza on top of a $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill on top of $5.7 trillion in six different types of COVID relief. And they have a bare majority, only 50 votes plus a tiebreaker out of 100 in the Senate and only a four-seat majority in the House. And the left is going to fight with what is left of the left center in the Democratic Party, and they're going to start fighting among themselves. And meanwhile, the centrists out here who are not very necessarily politically active but just want to be left alone, they tend to rise up when people push too far to the left. So there is hope. Ramesh was saying there is hope. So whether you're right or center or even center left, the idea is to bring Biden back toward the center that he claims to be sort of from. And if he governs, if he and Congress together govern from the center left, the damage is nowhere near as bad as if they govern from the left. And then, you know, we have elections every 2 years and presidential elections every four. The system actually does work. So have faith, people. Whether you're center, whether you're right, if you don't like the hard left turn, have faith. We are going to be back right after these messages and a short news break.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Hello, this is Quinn Hillier filling in for Sean Sullivan. And I am really thrilled as my last guest today to have one of my favorite people in all of the Washington media world, A.B. Stoddard. You have seen her for lo these many years on she is now mostly on MSNBC, CNN. She's an associate editor and columnist at Real Clear Politics. She's on Sirius XM POTUS channel. You've seen her on Fox News a lot for years. Everybody wants her because she's one of the most fair-minded, thoughtful, and usually accurate people out there. AB, welcome to the show.
Quinn, it's wonderful to be with you today. I'm so glad we could do this together.
Well, thank you for coming on. And I have treated our audience to a lot of conservative talk for the past hour and a half, and I wanted to bring it back to the big picture, neutral center, not filled up with ideology, but to get a realistic sense of where things stand. Politically, where do you think things stand in the country? Who's ascendant? Who is falling? What are the prospects for the next elections? Take it and run with it, AB. What's the big picture look like?
Well, thanks. I think, Quinn, like those of us who, the two of us included, have paid close attention to the actual minutiae and findings of the 2020 election. We're well aware that it was a huge pause for both parties. It did not answer a lot of questions. Biden barely won. And the Republicans held on pretty well down ballot. Democrats really are not dependent on activating their base as they are dependent on keeping Biden Republicans and Biden independents and former Republicans and suburban voters who they are currently renting and do not own. Over on the Republican side, they were elated to see how well President Trump did with working class non-white voters, particularly in Texas and Florida. That's great for the party if it is because they're attracted to the party. If it's just a Trump thing, we don't know if those gains will hold. If Josh Hawley is the nominee next time around. So a lot of questions for both parties still, not a lot of solid findings and direction, stuff for them to work with. I think the Democrats are in denial right now about how badly they're going to do next year. I think Republicans are definitely poised to take the House back and the good shot at the Senate as well, depending on who they nominate in open seats in North Carolina, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, places like that, places where Democrats are doing better. So I think that, generally speaking, we're going to see a Republican year next year. That'll determine, of course, who holds power or loses power in the midterms will determine, I think, the course of 24. If Trump's running, if he's devoured the Republican Party by then, which he seems intent to do, and, you know, that seems a little more wide open. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on. If we look to 23, 24, does Joe Biden run again? I think Democrats, you know, are quietly panicked about Kamala Harris not being being up to a national election. If she were to run, if she were to be challenged from the right by like a Pete Buttigieg, the progressives will make her a martyr and fight for her. If it's open, does she get challenged by a progressive, someone like Ayanna Pressley or someone like that, trying to push the party harder to the left? Very, very, very tense under the surface of the water on the Democratic side. The Biden administration should be credited with working to keep all of this extremely quiet. They've been successful at that, but those are sort of the questions around the corner. Does Nancy Pelosi leave? If Biden were to leave the House next year and Pelosi does retire, she has said she might. She's trying to be mysterious about it now. But she had said this could be her last term as Speaker. If she leaves and he is facing a Republican House that intends to impeach him no matter what, it will be the demand of the base. Who, you know, how many MAGA voters will insist that Trump be Speaker? On and on and on. There's a whole hellscape for Biden if he loses the House. And if he loses Nancy Pelosi, who is the most effective leader on that side, and brings in a new person from the next generation, you know, they're talking quietly about this now, you know, about maybe Jim Clyburn, you know, the assistant majority leader who's credited with making Joe Biden the nominee, if he would be an interim speaker, a sign the party is so nervous about turning the page in these politically turbulent times and actually moving on to new leadership. They would, the idea of the progressive seeing Biden as a temporary leader and then imagine Jim Clyburn coming in as a temporary speaker. There's a lot of division under the surface on the Democratic side that they're just successfully keeping quiet right now.
For the broader electorate, has the Democratic Party moved, or has the Biden administration tried to move too far to the left? And if so, has the Republican response been effective in a way that you know advantages Republicans without they themselves stepping into their own landmines?
Right. So what's interesting is, first of all, I'm going to start with the Biden administration's record. I think I'm going to look at it next year and look back, Quinn, okay, because I think that what he's trying to do is please progressives rhetorically with a lot of promises that I don't know are going to be kept. And that's a way of keeping the family fighting down to a dull roar. But I don't know. I think that what you see right now is his number one goal is a bipartisan infrastructure bill that's going to infuriate progressives, and he wants it more than he wants anything else. And they think it's too small, and they think it's a sellout, and they think it threatens the rest of their agenda. And, of course, it does. And I think that my view of Biden's governing is going to have to happen later, because I think he's doing a dance right now of trying to keep those progressives from open revolt. And that's how he's doing it, making all these promises that he doesn't have the votes for. In response to Republicans' campaign against the Democrats, you know, we'll see. We'll see if the bipartisan infrastructure bill gets passed. They have real substantive arguments to make, Quinn, on immigration and inflation and a spike in violent crime. So they don't have to do the culture wars. They don't have to lean into anti-vax madness and Dr. Seuss and trans athletes and the woke mob, although those are effective, because these are real vulnerabilities for Joe Biden with his own voters. Voters of every color in every neighborhood want security and safety in their neighborhoods. The crime thing is real. Inflation, rising prices, every economic level, that's real. And the out-of-control situation at the border. So I think that the Republicans have a strong hand. Their problem, I think, is Trump. But we're going to see that in the campaign next year. They are just holding on to Trump's ankles, hoping that as he flies around, his voters will turn out for them when he's not on the ballot. And that's their big gamble. Substantively, they have a winning hand.
You and I have had many discussions and emails about the Trump effect, both positive and negative. We only have about a minute, and we are in very Trump-friendly country. But as a just sort of as a neutral analyst, in 2022, if you had to say, do you think his continued activity, his continued insistence on trying to be the center of attention, does that help or hurt Republicans more, considering that some voters will only come out for him, but some voters are so turned off by him? You got about 1 minute.
Yeah, it's a high risk, Quinn. I mean, if he gets out there and truly campaigns for them and truly urges everyone to vote and does not tell them elections are rigged, it will work. It won't be the effect when he's on the ballot, but it will help them. If he does not, if he goes on these tours, talks about his grievances and prosecutorial, you know, misconduct and all these hoaxes and the big lie and says that all these election systems are rigged anyway, people feel that their vote isn't worth it. And that's what happened in Georgia, and it gave Democrats 2 Senate seats. So that's the gamble. And I think Republicans just don't know each day when Trump gets up and goes to a rally which channel he's going to be on.
That's very well put. I also like the way you put right at the very beginning about the suburbs being successfully rented by the Democrats but not yet owned. So basically what you're saying is we are at an inflection point, and there are a massive number of different ways that this could all go down. So hold on to your seatbelt. A.B. Stoddard, thank you very, very much for coming on the show, and thanks for all the good work you do.
Oh, thanks, Quinn. Great to be with you.
Thank you.